Well, thank you very much. One admin note to start with. I think the acoustics in this room are pretty good, but if at any time you can't hear a speaker, don't let him off. Do wave and get him to stand up or speak more loudly. Splendid attendance, even more splendid panel, I suppose I should say. And the subject is, as we were told, Iraq, what next? I suppose the focus of our thoughts recently has been on the surge. better days in Baghdad, perhaps, in terms of, anyway, of casualties among civilians, and curious developments to the north. What is going to be the longer term there? What about some economic development? Even more important, what about political reconciliation? The looming problem of Kirkuk, is it going to be manageable? So there's a host of questions we hope you may throw some light on. And the format is all on the record, unless the speakers say they want to say something in confidence. I'll ask them to speak for 5 to 8 minutes only, which is not really very much. And then we'll ask for questions from the floor, helpful if people say who they are if they're not very well known. And of course, I can't stop you making comments, but since we're here for the panel, let's keep the comments short and mainly concentrate on questions. So three panelists who don't really need introduction. Lord King on my right, in Parliament since 1970, was Employment Secretary and Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Defence Secretary under John Major during the Gulf War. After retirement to the backbenches, he became Chair of the Intelligence and Security Select Committee. And together with Lord Ashdown and Baroness Jay, he co-chaired the UK-Iraq Commission in 2007, which was facilitated by the Foreign Policy Centre in partnership with Channel 4. He'll speak first. Then Sir Peter Tapsell, the longest-serving Conservative MP in the House of Commons, elected in 1959, and has a loud voice. A front-bench spokesman on Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, 76 to 77, and on Treasury and Economic Affairs, 77 to 78. During the 1955 general election, he was personal assistant to Sir Anthony Eden. In 1993, he was voted the Spectator Backbencher of the Year. And in 2004, he was voted Parliamentarian of the Year. And he's one of the few Conservative MPs, I think I'm right in saying, to have consistently opposed the war in Iraq. Hajar Timurian, one of the best-known commentators on the Middle East, born in the Kurdish highlands of Iran. In 1968, he became a broadcaster with the Persian service of the BBC. In 1980, he was invited by the Times to join it as a writer specializing in the Middle East. During the crisis of the eviction of Iraq from Kuwait, he wrote a daily column in the Times and was employed by the BBC as one of its main commentators. Since 1996, he's been freelance. He has written a biography of Omar Khayyam. So there we are. I'd ask you, Lord King, to to lead
off. Everybody up. Right. Well, I assume that Sir Harold's voice, without a microphone, covered every corner of this room. Is that all right if I stay here and walk to the microphone? The title that I've been asked to talk to is What Next? And it'd be quite helpful in addressing what next if you knew what the present situation was. And I think this is one of the problems standing here in Whitehall at the present time. We talked about Ambassador Satterfield coming in and giving, as one would expect him to do, an encouraging and enthusiastic account of the success of the President's policies and understand the position that he is in. But to try and form a really objective view, the knowledge that so much of the stuff that we get out of Iraq, so much of the commentary that comes out of the green zone from people who don't think it's actually quite safe to travel too widely around the country, the difficulty of knowing whether we really have an accurate picture. Against that background, I just want to say that I've come as much to listen and to learn, and interesting comments from a number of people in this audience who are well informed on this subject, but I certainly am prepared to contribute my own opinion. on what I regard as an extremely grave and dangerous situation that we are in at the moment. And I think it's worth just, well, the purpose of today is not to have a post-mortem. The House of Lords on Thursday is going to have a debate on the lessons to be learnt. But today we're talking about what next. But the reality is that what next and the role that we can play, the options that are available to us, are very much limited by, unfortunately, some of the tragic mistakes we've made in the past. I just reflect, as you mentioned, I was Secretary of State for Defence at the time of the first Gulf War. And I think a lot of people have forgotten that the achievement of the ending of the aggression and the invasion of Kuwait and the expulsion of Saddam and Iraqi army from that ill-advised piece of aggression, the coalition actually assembled 750,000 troops to achieve it. We entered this much more difficult undertaking, not expelling an illegal invader from somebody else's country, but actually invading their own country and seeking to supplant their own existing government, with about 20% of the forces that we thought were necessary for achieving Kuwait. And that problem has just lived with us ever since. And that's why, when I have to say to you now, I think our options are extremely limited as to what we're able to do. And I have to say, I'm saying this also because the position that we face in Iraq is not something that we can address in isolation from the problems that exist and I think are growing more grave in Afghanistan. The NATO failure to achieve significant contributions from its member countries to the NATO force in Afghanistan does pose major dangers and major threats, and obviously has impact for the availability of resources that the British can devote to Iraq, or may well do in the future, and it's been one of the factors encouraging ministers to be able to describe rapid troop reductions in Basra, and the US Army also looking on the surge as a temporary undertaking. That background is a very real one. Now, I think, without getting too apocalyptic about it, no question, I think the situation at the moment is extremely grave. That although we notice, and the media, Basra is nothing like the news it was, because the British have withdrawn, they've handed over power to militias, and they've gone for the old British foreign policy technique of the balance of power, a balance of power between rival militias. And the allegations now that Basra has turned into a sort of sheer Taliban situation. These allegations, and people here may like to comment on that, I think is a very worrying situation. The Americans, likewise, have found that the way to tackle Al-Qaeda was to invest local assistance, and while it's quite clear that the surge has had some real success in the extra forces, it's also by getting the Sunni tribal leaders to see the threat that Al-Qaeda produced. It's come also by the dollar. I understand that a number of the militias are being paid $300 a month and given weapons to tackle Al-Qaeda and to keep order in their areas. And so you have, in fact, a reduction in violence achieved by a form of ethnic cleansing in the areas which have now got local militias controlling local areas. Now, that's all right in the short term, and maybe it was critical to reduce the level of violence. But when you then say, what next, it's not a very happy platform from which to embark on the current situation. And I think now the next 6 months are absolutely critical. It's very worrying that against this background, and if one has to recognise that although we wish to look on Iraq, and I certainly hope that Iraq will hold together as a single country, the debate at the moment of will it be central government control, will it be federalisation, or will it be partition? It's very much an open question at the present time. And this is what's one of the questions that I would like to put to you and my colleagues here, as to whether what I've always sensed was a real sense of, among certain people, of Iraqi nationalism, the threat of their neighbours and the external threat, and we recall the Iran-Iraq war, will actually prevail, or whether the temptations of separatism, the challenges, and Sir Harold, you referred to Kirkuk and the referendum, if Basra has 80% of the oil, the temptation for the Shia militias in the south to see that as a very tempting possession to hold on to and to keep to themselves. But against that background, I asked anybody here if they know Undermilt Wood, Dylan Thomas, and I drew an absolutely nil response from this audience. Anybody ever, but there's a wonderful line. Somebody can tell me. And Sir Peter said he thought I was half Welsh. I'm not half Welsh, I might be a quarter Welsh. But the wonderful line about, I come away and says, Waldo, what will the neighbours say? what will the neighbours say is, I think, an absolutely critical element in this. And the neighbours, of course, in particular Iran, Turkey, I'm not sure the Jordan quite then, Israel have slightly different issues, but Saudi Arabia as well, Kuwait, the Gulf states in their position. And the temptations to support their own particular teams, as it were, and if it came to civil war, the risk that they would get involved, at the same time, the threat to the region, if Iraq really did break down in chaos, and the risk obviously in the attitude of Turkey to any emergent Kurdistan, the attitude of Saudi Arabia and wishing to support their fellow believers, and the attitude of Iran as well, absolutely critical. And I think the jury, mine may sound very pessimistic on this, I think this is a very dangerous time in which the British contribution, I think, in many ways, is as importantly in the diplomatic, and I'm echoing here actually the Iraq Study Group, the that great paper produced with Jim Baker and his auspices at that time, that it's as much the diplomatic efforts as the military efforts. And I think, just if I added a point, military point of view, I noticed that Ambassador Crocker said that he hoped the British would stay in Basra, now on Basra Airport. The idea that we're about to pull out and the reductions are going to lead to a removal of British presence, the worry about the US supply routes, the need to try and be available at this difficult moment of challenge for the central government of Iraq, whether the Iraqi army, some improvement of the Iraqi police, that whether those elements can actually triumph against the dissident and dangerous tendencies that otherwise might split the country apart. And so not a very optimistic scenario. I think it's worrying against that background that one hears quite strong reports of strong of complaints from the army, the British army, about the failure of DFID, if I can bring it back to a more local level, to achieve more in the reconstruction and improvement of the condition of the people, because the next 6 months, some real improvement in that area as well will be an important ingredient in trying to enhance the reputation of the Iraqi government, central government, and try and ensure that otherwise the pressure of local dissidents and local militias don't otherwise split the country apart. And so I'm sorry, Sir Harold, not to be able to offer a more encouraging forecast. I think we have to stay neutrally for longer, and I think we have to really bend our shoulder to the wheel in the diplomatic efforts to try and ensure that the whole efforts of the region are to try and prevent those subversive and dangerous tendencies that might otherwise destroy Iraq.
Right, thank you very much for a cheerful start. Sir Peter Tapsell.
Well, I'm one of the neighbours, anyhow, in the lower house, and unlike Dylan Thomas. I haven't been brought up on milk, and I was told when I was dragooned into this rather forbidding undertaking, so many experts present, by Michael Ancrum, that I was to be undiplomatic and provocative, and therefore I hope that my dear friend Bruce Anderson and others will be as discreet as they usually are. The chairman's rather indicated already where I'm coming from, to use that ugly phrase. I regard the invasion of Iraq as having been a catastrophic strategic, political and humanitarian disaster. Now, we've only got 5 minutes, so I'm just going to attempt a series of very brief snapshots. And I think there are five alternatives on the question of next, all of them even more unsatisfactory than the alternatives to how you deal with the Northern Rock Bank problem, which we were talking about yesterday in the House of Commons. But the five possibles, it occurs to me, are either a continuation of present policy, which has been very well described by Lord King, or to go for a loosely linked federal state, or to go for outright tripartite partition, or, and this is where I move into the realms of controversy and why I've remained on the back benches for the last 48 years, either we bring back the Turks, who made a very good job of running the area for 400 years, or we wait for a clone to Saddam Hussein to re-emerge and restore order in the area. Now, if I could very briefly make just a few comments on each one of those five possibilities, and in the debate perhaps some of you may wish to take up different aspects of it. The continuation of present policy really depends, I think, on the outcome of the United States primaries, because it's pretty clear that if McCain or Mayor Giuliani become the Republican candidate, that they will commit themselves to a continuation, pretty well, of present policy. Whereas if Obama or Clinton become the Democrat candidate, they're, and as they've already done, make it clear that they're going to cut and run. They're going to do a Mountbatten, as it were, in India. Now, of course, one has to take what presidential candidates say in primary elections with a large pinch of salt, particularly when they are dealing with foreign affairs, as we all know, looking back over history. Nevertheless, it's very difficult to believe that President Obama, for instance, is going to allow Lord King's more optimistic, and he wasn't very optimistic, but not even going to give it a chance, I would have thought. And I doubt whether any of the others were. Indeed, I find it difficult to believe there's going to be an American presidential election from August onwards in which any of the candidates for the presidency are going to say that we're going to keep American troops in Iraq for any length of time. So that makes the difficulty about maintaining present policy, although I've not and have never been one of those who are in favour of cutting and running. Although I was absolutely opposed to going in, as we'd gone in, that we're saddled with that problem. I, in a different context about Afghanistan, when we were about to invade it, I quoted Duke of Wellington, who said it's easy to get into Kabul, but much more difficult to get out. And the same thing applies. The same thing applies to all these liberal interventionist ideas of Mr. Blair. Now, the second possible alternative is a loosely linked federal state. Well, I'm sure that would work. I have a home in Gestart, and I'm sure that it would work terribly well if Iraq was occupied by French and German Protestant or Catholic Swiss. But whether a loose federal state would work equally well with the present inhabitants of Iraq, I rather doubt. Then there is the outright tripartite partition. And it's worth remembering that the Turks, who govern the country for 400 years, I talk of course of the Ottoman Turks, who are very different to the modern Turks, but the Ottoman Turks governed the area for 400 years, and they had three different provinces for the three sections, the Shia, Sunni and Kurdish sections of the area, and they had three different governors, and they governed them as three different provinces for all that long period. So it's not very unusual, but, and it might very well work if you had somebody who could hold the whole thing together. The great problem about that is that it raises the Kurdish question. Now, I'd very much, if you've got time later and anybody asks me a question, I'd like to give you more extended views of Kurdistan. I've been all over Kurdistan, Kirkuk, Solomon Air and so on, and I've taken an interest in Iraq because my father, in the Indian Cavalry Regiment in the 39th century, into horse, rode on horseback from Basra to Mosul and was wounded by the Turks on the way. And I'm very interested. I probably am the only person in the room, because of my great age, who's actually talked to General Nuri, to General Qasim, to both the Arif brothers, and to Saddam Hussein. I'm not sure it's a proud boast. Perhaps it's a rather sad thing to have done in one's life. But it does, I think, indicate the difficulties of a tripartite partition in which the people are going to cooperate in any way. Because the one thing that those generals that I talked to all had in common was that they were in no way sort of exponents of Texas liberal republicanism. And they all believed in strong authoritarian government. Now, bringing back the Turks is the alternative to giving Kurdistan its independence. It's had near autonomy ever since Lord King helped to liberate Kuwait. And they are now very rich, or potentially very rich, and they were promised independence by President Woodrow Wilson in the 14th principle. Also, incidentally, as we're in the Lloyd George room, they were promised independence by Lloyd George. And it was only because President Woodrow Wilson had a stroke and Lloyd George fell from power that that didn't come about. But in the Sèvres Treaty of 1920, they were promised their independence. And it was only the emergence of General Kemal Ataturk, General Kemal as he was then, but overthrew all that. So that in the Lausanne Treaty of 1923, independence for the Kurds was forgotten. But they've not forgotten it. The post-war, post-1418 war settlements created the new Middle Eastern states of Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Jordan and Saudi Arabia. The one country that was omitted from that was Kurdistan, and they've never forgotten it. Let me tell you, if you go to Kurdistan, their historical memories are every bit as vivid as that of the Irish. And when I went first to Kurdistan in 1963, I met a distinguished man who was called the Red Mullah. And I think he's the Barzani, who I think is the father of the present Barzani. And he, at once when I met him, raised with me this whole question of the Treaty of Sèvres and the Treaty of Lausanne, which abandoned it. And so they naturally have a great urge to be an independent nation. And the almost insuperable problem about that is that it would throw Turkey, which has got 15 to 20 million Kurds in southeast, into a state possibly of chaos. And as the Syrians and the Iranians also have large populations of Kurds, poor Kurds have always been left out of the picture. But it's going to be a very real problem for Turkey if the unitary state of Iraq, which Lord King favours, cannot be retained. And then, as I say, we wait for the clone to Saddam Hussein to appear. Although the Shia are in huge majority in terms of numbers, all history shows that Iraq can only be governed by Sunnis. I don't know why that should be so, but it has always been the case. And I'm quite certain that you're never going to get anything like a peaceful, unitary state in Iraq unless you have a strong Sunni leader. Now, that's a highly controversial thing to say. I've been torn to pieces in many parts of the Middle East, no doubt, for saying that. But I believe it to be true. And as I say, I've met most of the leaders of Iraq over the last 58 years, whatever it is, since I met General Nouri. And that is the position. And I think we may go through a whole variety of these five alternatives. But we're going to finish up with some strong general taking power in Iraq and reimposing law and order. And we will, when that happens, have sacrificed the lives of 150,000 Iraqis for no purpose whatever.
Well, you answered the question, Sir Peter, the question on the paper. What? Yes. Now, Hajir, what's your answer?
Yeah. First of all, apologies for writing my speech because I thought you are an influential lot. I want to mean every word I say. No loose language yesterday. But Iraq and I also go back a long way together. And unfortunately, almost all of it has been a tale of woes. My first memories of the place as I grew up are happy enough. Radio Suleymaniye in Kurdish, in Iraqi Kurdistan, painted a thriving picture of cultural life over the border, unlike in our part of Kurdistan, where our language was forbidden to be written down, as in Turkey still is, and Syria. Iraq, as with Iran, had a monarchical system, paternalistic, wanting to be nice to all the communities, though of course firmly in the hands of the minority Sunni Arabs. This had been imposed on the country by Britain in the wake of the First World War, but before that, for several hundred years, by Ottoman Turks. Anyway, their monarchy was much more liberal than ours, at least as far as restrictions on Kurdish language and culture were concerned. I was a monarchist at the time because I had developed a crush on Princess Shahnaz Pahlavi, the late Shah's eldest daughter, and saw in the magazines the occasional story about the young King Faisal II of Iraq too, who was perhaps only a year or two older than myself. But then came the terrible shock. In July 1958, I remember it very vividly, I was listening to the radio. In July 1958, the King and a number of his relatives and ministers, including Nouri Said, were murdered in a noisy revolution, and their bodies were dragged on the streets of Baghdad. I was disgusted, of course. Decent people didn't do that. Only barbarians did. Little did I know that one day, one of those barbarians, a young man called Saddam Tekriti, who was in the mob, would dominate my life in London as a journalist. What that revolution indicated immediately was that Iraq was a land of high passions, but that, I can now see, has been the curse of the place for a much longer time. It was there, after all, 3,000 years ago, that the Assyrian state first institutionalized the use of terror as an instrument of political control. And I swear that Saddam had inherited many more Assyrian genes than was his fair share even in northern Iraq, the former heartland of the Assyrians. At the height of his barbarities, for example, in the 1970s, when I smuggled myself into Kurdistan, I was foolish enough to report on the plight of the Kurds, when he was destroying thousands of Kurdish villages and no one cared in the outside world except the odd newspaper in London or New York, I saw that his eyes were accurately depicted in ancient Assyrian statutes. Let me jump to more recent events. In the months preceding the Anglo-American invasion of 2003, I was in a small, largely academic team that gathered once a week at the Department of War Studies at King's College here in London, that tried to predict what might happen if an invasion really did take place. The program was financed by the Ministry of Defense, and at the other end of the table were some of the senior military who were planning for the political and economic aftermath of an invasion. The reports of our brainstorming quickly became highly prized in Whitehall, we were told, and even across the Atlantic, we were flattered to hear they caught the attention of the decision makers. I remember one day I said the Iraqi military's will to resist will dissipate the moment they see on Al Jazeera television that American and British troops have actually crossed the Kuwaiti border into Iraq. That was easy enough to predict. So was my other prediction that all Iraqi government officials, from teachers to policemen to judges, would flee southern Iraq before they were lynched by Shia mobs. One of the generals across the table said, "That's what we call catastrophic success." We all laughed. We hadn't heard of that expression before. And surely enough, that's exactly what happened. A vacuum of authority came into being that could only be filled by criminals and fanatics and Iranian agents from across the border who hated their fellow Shias in Iraq to become a beacon of inspiration to their own disgruntled masses. Elected government, the Ayatollah Sistani with his relatively moderate views, opposed to Khomeini, a jostling, exciting press, that was a nightmare to Ayatollah Khamenei in Tehran, and it still is. He, the Ayatollah in Tehran, would far prefer a Saddam Hussein, the hammer of his fellow Shias in Iraq, to be in place there rather than any Western influence. So in that vacuum, the Americans and the British and the Australians were never going to have enough troops to rule every street. Nor was it possible to retain the hated old army. Even the Shia junior officers were seen by the majority community as traitors. Later, Iraqis were critical of the Americans for retaining the color of the uniform of the old army. Imagine what would have happened if their former tormentors still filled those uniforms. Surely that would have been proof enough for the Iraqis, for the Shias anyway, and the Kurds, that the Americans meant to do what the British had done before, to impose minority Sunni rule over them again. Some of the mistakes definitely did happen. The resentful Sunni areas of western and northern Iraq were left to their own devices for too long, and some of the junior Ba'athist officers in the security forces were not retained in those areas to help to maintain security. Having said that, some Sunni resistance, perhaps fierce resistance, was surely inevitable. The place was awash with illicit weaponry distributed by the old regime or stolen from the army. And such neighbors as the Syrians were not going to stop well-financed Saudi and other jihadists passing through their borders into Iraq to make trouble. Similarly, Iran thought that America was tied down in both Iraq and Afghanistan and decided to pile on the pressure. I'm glad we are having this debate at a time when better news comes out of Iraq. Perhaps we may argue that the Iranians, the Syrians, and the foreign jihadists have actually helped Iraqis to see who their enemies genuinely are. Historians may perhaps one day, I hope, say that the pain of the past few years brought Sunnis and Shias together so that for the first time in the history of modern Iraq, Arab Iraq, they became a nation. We must be careful here not to raise our hopes too much. I do not personally believe that the strongly religious, particularly Islamic society, can ever be tolerant enough of dissident views or minority rights to be a democratic society. And in Iraq particularly, religion is strong and so is Arab nationalism. I can unfortunately see that before too long, the central government in Baghdad will gang up together with the Turks, the Iranians, the Syrians to strangle the landlocked Iraqi Kurds. So the Kurds need wise and moderate leadership to realize that they are surrounded by enemies. Their present leadership ought to be advised to clamp down on activities of the PKK on their soil. And that leadership of the Iraqi Kurds needs to cut all ties with Iran to prove its true gratitude to the only true protector it has, the United States of America. To sum up, I do expect that in a few years' time, we shall still see a reasonably open society in Iraq, as we have in Kuwait today, for example. And as the country becomes more prosperous with the development of the oil fields, the political class in Baghdad will not forget to whom it owes its salvation: the United States, Britain, and Australia, and some other smaller powers, who risked the lives of their young men and women to end one of the most horrendous genocidal regimes in the region since Assyria. That political class will also hopefully not forget who stood in the way of its salvation: the French, the Russians, the Chinese, and Iraq's own neighbors, Iran and Turkey in particular. I am less confident on this particular last point, but I do expect that Iraq will still, in a decade's time, be a strong ally for America and Britain when we will need strong allies in that region very badly. Thank you.
Thank you, Hajar.